Okay, go ahead and get started. Okay, again, announcements. So today we are going to end part one of the book of the course, which is covering steady state techniques for converter analysis. If there's time, we'll start into part two, which is dynamic operation, no longer operating in steady state. That means that we're going to have a midterm exam, which will cover up through chapter six, through the material today. There's relatively little new material today, but basic converter analysis, average modeling, small ripple approximation, losses, device implementation, transformer isolated converters, DCM, these are the topics for this, the homework up to and including the current homework. Okay. So that's why it won't be until next week. I want to give you a chance to finish this homework, look over the solutions over the weekend, ask me any questions you have about them, either over the weekend or at the beginning of class, a week from today on Monday, and then we'll move into the exam. My proposal for this course is to give you a take-home midterm. I'm amenable to doing it in class if people prefer that. But the plan would be, if it's take home, give it out at the end of class Monday. It'll be due Friday, like a normal homework of that week to complete it. Length would be comparable to a typical homework. Comparable to your homework this week. People have opinions on that?
What kind of, like, the homework should bring?
And I've also heard your take homes are like really, really difficult. So I'm like, level of difficulty, how much more difficult is the in class versus the take home?
Equal.
Equal? Okay, no. Then take home.
Yeah. Obviously. No, it will be different. When I give take-home exams, there are things that require a little bit more thought because you have the extra time. In class, the problems have to be a little different. I can't rely on, well, I've got some time to think through this, and I can go look at the book and look up solutions for the forward and use those in my answer. My goal, regardless of whether it's in class or take-home, my goal in writing exams is always to make it so that it is only covering things, only covering theory that we've covered in lecture. But if you try to just do a rote application of something from lecture, you'll get it wrong. There's no place where, well, if I just copy down the flyback solution we did in class on this problem, I'll get full points. It's always different enough. You have to think about, okay, we did it this way for the flyback. Let me use those same techniques for this weird looking converter. All the steps are the same. All the theory is the same. But it requires, do you understand the material? You're just copying things over from lecture. That's what I want to catch. Make sure you understand the concept, not just the equations that we showed. Okay. Other questions on that? Thoughts? I really don't think my exams are that hard.
One midterm and then a final?
Correct.
Do we have one more lab in class?
Two more labs. Next one will be potentially the week following the midterm. We'll see where we get, but we won't have it during the midterm.
Are you going to do it in class or out of class? The lab, that is.
The lab?
Yeah.
I don't know. Likely out of class.
Okay.
Last time was nice in that I had this travel anyway. But I do still want to cover all the topics for the course. It was likely to be scheduled outside of class hours. Okay. That question reminds me, so what we'll do, if everybody agrees to take home, we'll do a take home. The final is going to be the same thing. I believe the final, if you want to do in class, then the final will also be in class. I think I want for the final to be a type of exam you've seen from me before. So I won't switch it up between midterm and final. Okay. That being the case, we'll talk about it more when we get there. Rules on midterm exam, that is a take home, are absolutely no collaboration, including with third parties. So no talking to each other about the exam, no talking to students who've taken it before, no talking to people in online forums or going to websites other than the course website. But it is open book, open note, open course website then. You can use all those resources, but only those resources. Okay? Other questions related to this, related to anything else in the class? Can we jump in? Okay, the moment there is not any breakdown between midterm and lab, that's important, I can come up with a number.
Okay, I mean, that's not that
bad. Yeah.
Is it still different for 81 and
599? Yeah, all exams will be. Generally, the 599 exam is the 481 exam plus an extra subpart to all problems or a couple of the problems. It requires a little bit more, typically down thinking about design or something a little bit more high level about the converters. Okay. Other questions? Okay, not, we'll continue on. So last time we were discussing this flyback converter, which was another of these isolated topologies, a bit different than the others that we had looked at so far, in that most of the other converters were buck derived, meaning they were gonna have their main energy storage element inductor being at the output, being separate from the transformer. The flyback was buck boost derived. The way we got this is by replacing the main inductor of the buck boost with the transformer. So now the energy storage element is actually the magnetizing inductance. This is the first converter where the magnetizing inductance is actually critical to circuit operation. All the other ones, it was parasitic. So we looked at these buck derived converters. This was a buck boost drive. There are boost derived isolated converters. They kind of follow the buck drive but have an inductor at the input. They're less common in practice. We won't cover those in any detail. So this flyback thing, we went through and analyzed volt second balance on the magnetizing inductance. Was part of our critical path here. We can go through and solve for things like conversion ratio, average input current, magnetizing current. Just as an example and kind of as review with the midterm coming up, went through and did some reverse recovery switching loss analysis and then included that in an average model. Okay. So just want to look at some details of the performance of this flyback. On this slide, what I have here for the boost converter are these plots we did many weeks ago of the conversion ratio versus duty cycle for some range of inductor resistance, RL, where if I go this way, RL is increasing for a given output load. So each of these curves are for an RL divided by R. R is the output. What we saw is that with any actual conduction losses in this converter, the boost can't go up to infinite conversion ratio, kind of peaks somewhere. It depends on how much resistance we have. If we have a whole lot of resistance, I can hardly get any voltage gain out of it. If I have a smaller amount of resistance, I may be able to get up to 5 or 10x conversion ratio step up in this boost. Okay. The flyback, as an example, if I put a 100 to 1 turn transformer in it, I get kind of very similar looking curves. But now I have this integrated 100x step up from the transformer. So I can get these same curves, but maybe get a gain of 100 out of it. Okay. So this can do much better. This still maybe has some impractical details to it, in that a 1 to 100 transformer is real hard to create without a lot of parasitics and loss mechanisms. I'm trying to couple just one turn onto 100 turns, that can be difficult. But incorporating this transformer lets me get much higher conversion ratios, step up or step down, much more simply. I'm not forcing myself to go to very extremes of the duty cycle to get to a high step up, that I can be somewhere in the middle and get a gain much larger due to this turns ratio. One other thing that I'm just going to mention as a practical detail here, but it's something that becomes important and limits the flyback converter, is the effect of leakage inductance on converter operation. I'm going to look at is I have this transformer, and we have been analyzing LM, magnetizing inductance. And that's a critical part of converter operation that's needed for the flyback to work, and we use that in its operation. But there's this other inductance that we mentioned previously, LK, the leakage inductance of a transformer, and any real physical transformer will have this due to any flux from the primary winding, which does not go through the secondary winding. That creates self-inductance instead of mutual inductance. And I can design this thing such that LK is much less than LM, but LK is now some parasitic non-zero inductance. It's going to be there, and it's going to affect my circuit operation. Okay. So what is this going to do in circuit? I'm going to look at the current through the magnetizing inductance, the second plot IK, the current through that leakage inductance, and down here I'm going to do the drain to source voltage on this transistor. Okay. So magnetizing inductance, kind of looked at before, if I'm in CCM, it should be some triangle wave like this, ramps up at VG over LM, down at minus V over NLM. Okay. That's all normal. Then this leakage inductance, if it is indeed present, would have a current equal to the magnetizing inductance in the first interval. So when Q1 is on, I have kind of a loop here with VG, LK, LM, and Q1 shorted, right? Everything directly in series. Okay. I could go back and say maybe this slope before it was VG over LM, maybe it should be some impedance divider with LK now, but LK is much less than LM, so I can assume that all the voltage drop is still on the magnetizing inductance and hasn't really affected anything yet. Okay. This time the FET is on, so VDS is zero. And then at DTS, I turn off Q1. Okay. The magnetizing current now circulates through the transformer, flows through the output diode to the output. But LK cannot, right? Not in parallel with this transformer. There's only one current path that LK can flow in, and it's this path. Once I shut off Q1, there's no path, so this current goes to zero. Okay. Once this thing shuts off, D1 turns on, the output voltage is reflected back and flipped across the transformer. So the total voltage VDS is the input plus the reflected output across the transformer turns winding. So this will go up to VG plus V over N. Any problems? How do people feel about this? What do I need to get an instantaneous drop in an inductor current? I need infinite voltage applied to it, right? So, yeah, this is problematic, right? Once I put this thing in there, this can't happen if my voltage waveforms are such. So as I've argued it, there is, once Q1 turns off, it's an open, there's no path for this thing to go, so it has to drop down to zero, and there has to be some kind of infinite spike to do that. More practically, what happens is there is still a path, and it has to do with something we've looked at before, parasitic drain to source capacitance of the MOSFET. So what's going to happen is the energy stored in that leakage inductance is going to continue to flow. It's going to go into this drain to source capacitance and increase its voltage until it gets high enough to bring the current in LK down to zero. What that looks like is there's going to be a fixed rate rise in this voltage. At this point, voltage on Q1 is VG plus V over N. V over N reflected here, VG here, so that puts 0 volts upon LK. That'll keep its current flat. It's going to keep dumping. So this is going to then overshoot up to some high peak, and then I'm going to see ringing resonance with this I sub K. So I'm going to have some very high peak stresses on this MOSFET due to this leakage inductance dumping out into the drain source capacitance. Okay. Practically, this is an issue for a couple of reasons. First, can cause an overvoltage on the FET. Second, this will result in energy loss. And that energy loss takes the form of energy stored in the leak inductance, call it E sub K. Before this switching interval, it's going to look like 1/2 LK times IM squared. I call this point neglecting ripple is just IM. The energy that that leakage inductance has, because current IM is flowing through it before the interval starts, that energy is going to ring out, and due to parasitic resistances, my switching period is long enough, this rings out and steadies out. That means all of that energy is lost. So I have a power loss that's this energy times FS every period from just dissipating all that energy that was trapped in the leakage inductance. So I didn't include the slide, but when we looked at that practical implementation of the iPad charger, there was an auxiliary circuit to handle this. One of the most common ways, particularly in low-cost flybacks, is to put something like a Zener clamp here. Zener diode and a regular diode. What that'll do is it'll clamp this voltage to some VG plus Zener voltage of the diode. I designed this with VZ, my Zener voltage, less than V out over N. Excuse me, greater than. If it's less than V out over N, it'll be forward bias. The Zener will be, well, not forward bias, Zener breakdown, reverse bias. During normal operation, I want it to clamp somewhere up here so that it doesn't affect my normal operation, but clamps and prevents this high peak. so I can design, like it's easy to do that. This will address point number one, limiting the maximum peak voltage, preventing it from damaging my MOSFET. Will not address point number two, still just dissipating that energy, but I'm doing so without allowing a high peak. Okay. There are other implementations. You use a diode and a resistor and a capacitor, that's also lossy. If you incorporate a capacitor, an active switch, do some things with modulation, you can get rid of this energy loss. That plays on resonant circuit analysis, something we cover in ECE 581. Okay. Practical detail, but this is one that is important in actual implementation, these flyback converters. This ringing and overvoltage due to the leakage inductance has killed many a flyback converter. All right, so the last section of chapter 6 gets into kind of a real light introduction to converter design and some metrics which you might want to think about when you're selecting for a given application. Do I want this to be a boost? Do I want it to be a flyback? Do I want it to be a buck boost or a forward or anything else? Right? And the things introduced in this chapter are switch stress and switch utilization, which are two concepts that I'm going to talk about here in an example comparison. I'm going to compare the boost and the flyback, and I'm going to give some example numbers. Let's say this is a VG is 1 volt, Vout is equal to 100 volts, Pout is 100 watts. So from the discussion earlier in today's lecture, which of these do you expect to be a better option? Probably flyback, right? Boost is going to have a real hard time with a 100x step up, right? Faucet is shown. So here, I can let the transformer do the majority of that 100x step up. Here, I've got to do it all with extreme duty cycles, okay? But let's look at this another way. So in the boost, what I want to look at is the active switch rating. Active switch means transistor. So I'm going to look at, if I were to select a device to implement Q1, what would I need for the ratings of that device at minimum? Okay. So Q1 needs to meet, if we think back to when we were doing switch implementation, I'm going to need a device that can conduct current I on and block the voltage V off. So in the boost converter, VG is 1 volt, IL is 100 amps, V out is 100 volts. And okay, when the device is on, it's conducting the inductor current, which is 100 amps. When Q1 shuts off, V1 turns on, shorting 100 volts, drain to source, needs to block 100 volts. Okay, and then we introduce a concept here, S, what we call the switch stress. Is equal to I on times V off. In this case, that's equal to 10 kVA. Important to call it kVA. It's not watts. This is not real power. I never simultaneously have the on-state current and the off-state voltage. I do one, then the other. But multiplying them together here to get a net metric that says, what do kind of the ratings of this thing need to be? This needs to be a 100 volt, 100 amp switch. Call that a 10 kVA switch. Okay. So I need a 10 kVA switch at a converter that has an output power of 100 watts. Seems overkill. Okay. And that's because in this non-isolated converter, this transistor has to conduct the input current and block the output voltage. The step-up converter, that's the worst of both, right? Got a small input voltage and a small output current, but this thing doesn't see the small thing. It sees the big one. Okay. So now let's compare with the flyback. Flyback is going to depend on the turns ratio. I'm going to let turns do all the work and set N is equal to 100. Let them do the step up for me. Okay. So if I do that, Q1 in this case, I on, V off, just solved in this previous slide, was VG plus V over N. I'm going to neglect this leakage inductance non-ideality. I can clamp that, do whatever I want with it. Be VG plus V over N. Output voltage is 100 volts, turns ratio of 100, reflects back through is 1 volt, input voltage is 1 volt, so that's 2 volts. Okay, my on state current, if I go through and solve, this looks like NV over RD prime for this converter. We've got V over R, goes through the diode during the D prime interval, reflect that back through the transformer. That's the magnetizing current. And if I plug in and solve D is a half when the turns ratio does all the work, this becomes 200 amps. Okay. So I still have 100 amps average. The boost converter, my input current is small ripple, nearly DC. And the flyback, it's pulsating. The duty cycle of a half, I have 200 amps for half the period to give me that 100 amps average. And I'm worried about what is the actual current when it conducts, not the average. Call same as when we were doing switch implementation. We care about at a given time T, how much current is it conducting, not anything about the average. It needs to be rated for the peak. Okay. So from these, then my S, I on V off is now 400 VA. At the out of 100 watts. Okay, so here, using a switch whose stress is, in some sense, 100 times the actual power going through the converter, here I just have a factor of 4. I can use a much smaller switch here. Because this transformer kind of isolates the high current stuff from the high voltage stuff, whereas in the boost, everything's lumped together. Okay, so that's the stress of an individual switch. A couple other things we defined, nomenclature here. My total active switch stress called S total is just the sum over all of my active switches, all of my transistor type elements. Don't care about diodes for this metric, of their individual stress is sum over all switches of V off of that switch times I on of that switch. Okay. As with switch implementation, we care about not average values. For V off, I care about the peak. I'm going to have to select a transistor which can block the peak voltage ever seen in normal operation. And for I on, we can use the peak, or perhaps more useful might be RMS. Okay. So peak's fine, it tells me my transistor needs to be rated for at least this current, but like we talked about when we were in the switch implementation section, current rating really doesn't mean much for transistor type devices. What you care about in selecting how big is it is the conduction losses. You care more about RMS currents. But either one's fine as long as you're consistent. This is a metric we're going to use to look at the merits of converters. So So if I'm analyzing three or four different converters, I can choose them and do all of them with RMS currents or all of them with P currents. As long as I'm consistent, it's fine. And the last thing here, is we define something called switch utilization. Give the parameter U, and that's just equal to the output power of the converter divided by this total active switch stress. Okay. This is a quantity to be minimized. Now, this whole analysis of what's really the significance of switch stress and switch utilization is a bit nebulous. What it's meant to do is, for a given topology, give you some kind of insight into either what's the performance of a given switch going to be, or how much am I going to have to pay to get a good switch for this application. So it's going to be much harder for me to get a 100-volt, 100-amp device than it's going to be for me to get a 200-volt, 200-amp, 2-volt device. Okay? Exactly how that plays out, the book gives kind of a rough proportionality equation here, where it says, okay, my semiconductor cost, dollars per converter, if I have a given output power or a given set of ratings. So the cost of all these active switch elements is very approximately equal to some dollars per VA rating of the switches, which is not at all a constant in things out there, where this kind of loses some of its utility in actually applying this equation. But the general idea holds. So if there's some cost per switch, if I go from the same manufacturer, the same device, same voltage rating, a higher current rating is going to cost me more money. It holds true in that. Once you start jumping different manufacturers, different lines of devices, it's not going to hold as well. Okay. And then we'll have some safety factors. So if my device has to block 100 volts, I'm not going to buy a 100-volt device, because then if there's any noise, it fails. I'm going to buy maybe a 200-volt device, which would be a 0.5 safety factor on the voltage rating, somewhere on the current rating. So there's some additional built in. That 10 kVA switch, I'm going to have to actually buy a 20 kVA switch at least. Okay. Those are the real stresses. I don't want to hit the rating. And then this utilization U. Okay. Just something I want to maximize that's done by minimizing the total switch stress. So ideally, conceptually, if I've got a given output power, I'd like to implement a converter that has one switch whose VA rating is only that output power. And my one switch sits at the input, it blocks the input voltage, conducts the input current, rated at same value as P out and VA rating. Okay. Practically, that may not be possible. So here's switch utilization for some various converters. This is a table from the book, table 6.1. It also kind of shows another problem with this utilization metric is there's a lot of kind of trivial or useless optimization that can be done here. So the buck converter has a utilization of 1, switch stress equal to the output power that we wanted, but add a duty cycle of 1. So if the thing doesn't change the voltage, it's got very low cost switch, but a piece of copper wire would be even lower cost for that conversion ratio. Okay. You can get some trivial things. My opinion, this metric overall is perhaps less useful than just understanding this concept of a converter where I have to buy a much higher rated switch to do the same conversion. is likely to either be much more expensive or at the same cost, much higher losses. So I'm not going to be able to get as low of an R-on out of that switch because of those higher ratings. Okay, this then leads to discussion of, okay, how do we go about designing a converter? Now I graduate, I go take a job in industry, I'm a power electronics engineer, and they come to me and they say, here's the application, we need these ratings, figure out how to do it. Okay. And there is no definitive way to go about that process, from kind of a black box model with just input and output, figure out, okay, what's the optimal topology, what devices should be in here. Tends to be more of an art than a science. Additionally, there's a lot of practical factors that are going to significantly influence your converter. Things like layout, how much parasitic inductance you get in your converter because of that, and these different connections, how you implement the gate driver. Do these devices really switch almost instantaneously, or does it take some time, have additional switching losses? If it's higher power, how do I keep it from overheating? High efficiency, it's generating a lot of heat to the power loss. What sort of things am I using to implement inductors and devices? So these ideas, switch stress and utilization, give some insight onto, well, this topology may be a better fit. Kind of pull this, okay, this flyback may be a much better idea in this high step up case. But there's a whole lot of other things that'll go into it. So typical process is somewhat heavily based on designer intuition, based on really digging in and running your comparison. Okay. So the way we're going to talk about here is a parametric design. Look at what are the design freedoms I have in a given converter, and I'll go through and solve the converter and then start playing with my design freedoms and looking at my solution, how it changes. This biases us towards using something like Excel or MATLAB. For example, I'll take the flyback converter, I'll program into MATLAB all of my analysis of it, solve out which stresses, solve out what's the current through all the devices, what's the voltage on all the devices. And then I'll go back at the top where I define the turns ratio and start changing it to different values, see how it affects my operation, see if there's the design I like in there. Okay. I might do that with multiple converters. So I'm just going to kind of quickly jump through an example the book gives. So this is, in this case, mostly done in Excel as a spreadsheet. That works as well. MATLAB tends to be a bit better tool these days. This is the design of a high step down converter for really offline applications. The power is a little high, but it's a system where I would have 230 volts AC, go through something like a diode rectifier, probably a full bridge rectifier here to a big cap, and that would generate approximately 300 volt bus, peak rectifying that 230 RMS. Then this is the converter I'm trying to design. So it's going to step down to 15 volts output. So this is fixed output voltage, some kind of power supply. It's not for any specific application. Ratings are somewhat similar to a laptop charger. Laptop chargers are typically 19 volts and 200 watts is maybe a bit much for a laptop charger, but comparable to that. Okay. So these are the kind of specs I'm given by my boss at work. He wants this AC input, which will result in, depending on factors in the grid and loading, an input voltage between 260 and 390. I've got some range at the input. I want my output to be 15 volts with 100 millivolts of ripple. And my load is between 20 and 200 watts. So these will all be specifications to my design. That's what I'm starting from. Switching frequency, more often than not, is a design parameter, something that I get to choose as a designer. But kind of at our simple model here, if I'm considering only conduction loss, it doesn't have all that much of an effect other than on ripple. The main things that are going to go into the selection of that switching frequency is switching losses, and then also any requirements on EMI going back into the grid, something we haven't covered and won't cover in this course. Okay. So we're just going to fix that. So we're going to compare two converters, a forward and a flyback, and do so parametrically. What I mean by that is I'm not going to decide on a given switch with the given on resistance or resistance of the windings of my transformers. Instead, what I'm going to look at is just the ideal converter. What are the voltages and currents everywhere throughout it? And then compare the two independent of how I choose to implement those devices. Like we saw with the boost and the flyback, ratings on those devices were very different. And picking the same device for both would not be a fair comparison. The device that worked well in that boost, which was 100 volts, 100 amps, would not work well in the flyback that was 2 volts, 400 amps. So I'm going to compare independent of the actual switches themselves and decide which one looks better. Then I go through the step of implementing the actual switches, selecting transistors. So here's my forward converter. Turns ratio is defined here, and inductor current ripple is defined. These are all design variables. So I can change around any of the turns ratios, N1 to N2 and N1 to N3, and I can change around the inductor current ripple. I have a spec only on the output voltage ripple. That's all that the load is going to see. Okay. My current ripple is bigger. I'm going to need a bigger cap to meet the voltage ripple, but still something I get to decide. Okay, same thing for the flyback. Now there's only one turns ratio, and inductor current ripple I can set as I please. Okay. I'm going to look at the design and CCM for both of them at kind of full load. More often than not, the full load operating condition with the highest output power is the one that limits your design when the stresses are going to be the worst. So that's the one you start from designing. Okay, going through the analysis. First, I think the slides here, I'm just going to show the forward converter. I'm going to jump through this very quickly. This is all stuff we've done before. Okay, this is reiterating that this delta I is a design variable. I can solve for the ripple in this output inductor and the forward converter. And I can set it as I please, but it's going to have some trade-off of the output capacitance to meet the voltage ripple spec. And I can solve, when is this thing going into DCM? If I drop the output power down from 200 watts down to 20, depending on how I design it. Keep it in CCM always, or it could move over into DCM at some point, in which case for those powers, the equations defining current and voltage stresses change to the DCM equations. Okay. Stresses, we looked at the voltage stresses on the forward converter a class or two ago. They were the input voltage plus the input voltage times the scale factor due to this reset winding. We make this N1 over N2 larger, we can go to higher duty cycles, but we get more voltage stress on the transistor. Solve the RMS current through it. Using these tables in the back of the book, I can sketch out what the current looks like. I know the peak and average values. I use the tables in the back to give me the RMS. Okay, and what I end up with is some set of stresses on the forward converter, and then do the same thing on the flyback. And I have this all in a spreadsheet, where up here are my design variables for each, so things like the turns ratios and this delta I, and then embedded in each of these cells are these calculating equations. So this is, you know, some formula in Excel, so that as I change these design variables, my turns ratio, my current ripple, I see everything instantly propagate through an update, and I can kind of fiddle with these knobs to compare the designs. Okay. So at the moment, it's at a comparable turns ratio in both, a little bit higher current ripple out in the flyback. That results in these sorts of stresses. So the transistor voltage is much greater in the forward converter. Due to this reset winding, it's going to have higher peak voltage stresses on that primary side device than the flyback. The current is a little bit greater in the flyback for this primary side switch, and this is the utilization U, fairly comparable in both. When I look at, this was all my Q1, this is all my output diodes. I have just one in the flyback, and I have two diodes in the forward converter on the secondary. I look at the stresses of those. Blocking voltage is a little bit greater in the flyback, but the RMS current is much greater. Output diode is 9 amps RMS. The other one has 11 in the forward converter. 16.3 amps RMS in the flyback. I can expect much larger losses in that output diode. Currents in Q1 are pretty comparable. 1.13 amps, 1.38 amps, a little bit higher in the flyback. Given on resistance, I expect pretty similar conduction losses in both. And I would need a higher voltage device forward to this higher blocking voltage. Output capacitor current is this last one that's, again, much greater in the flyback, meaning I'm going to need, this is AC, a higher RMS, higher AC component. I'm going to need a bigger capacitor in the flyback in order to meet my ripple spec. And I'm going to potentially have more losses in that capacitor if it has any resistance, any sort of ESR of the capacitor. Okay. So it's a nuanced discussion. At this power, likely the forward converter may win, but there is no definitive answer to that. I can play with this design a little bit. I can push the turns ratio around to try to put more stresses on the switch and fewer stresses on the output diode and the flyback, or vice versa. But my design process would be looking at this, and then from these stresses, I can go to device implementation. So I start actually selecting a MOSFET, selecting a diode, designing my transformer, picking output capacitor, and then I can evaluate losses. But this is a difficult thing. Discretize, it's subject to commercial availability. I don't want to be just doing that for arbitrary design. I kind of use this parameterized analysis to push the design towards somewhere I think can do well, and then select the devices that will have low loss under these stresses. Then I can start looking and comparing based on losses. Depending on what my boss is happy with, maybe he just wants high efficiency, or maybe he also wants me to be optimizing for low cost or for small size, for reliability. He doesn't want to have to go out and replace these for all his customers. Maybe even more that I have to consider than just what the losses are. Okay. Next few slides here, I think, are just some discussion of different aspects of this comparison, showing that the reset mechanism of the flyback is superior to the forward. That's because it has this smaller blocking voltage and has no limits on duty cycle. So the forward is gonna kind of lose in that battle, but it's gonna do a little bit better in transistor utilization. In transistor current, it's a little bit worse in utilization. But higher currents in the flyback, and then particularly at the output, much worse in the flyback. Peak diode current of 22 amps versus around 10 amps, about half that in the forward converter. This is common of the flyback, this pulsed output current. Hertz designs, as I start going towards higher current, the flyback converter usually only used in low power kind of applications. Like I said, with this iPad charger, I can have low enough power that I can get away with the hit and efficiency. Flyback is the simplest thing. Lowest number of components, lowest requirements. So I'd go that direction. Okay. So that's all of chapter six. Summary, chapter six, what we're looking at is different topologies, and particularly the new things were transformer isolated converters. This is useful for high conversion ratios or if isolation is required for safety reasons. The way we analyze them, just the way we analyze every other converter. The only potential difference is that we need to ensure volt second balance on the magnetizing inductance, even if it's not really used in the converter operation, as it wasn't in these buck drives. The flyback definitely needs to do it as part of the main operation. Regardless, we need to make sure we do not saturate this transformer. As far as design goes, design of power electronics is a very nuanced and multivariate optimization procedure. These things like switch stress and utilization kind of guide you in the direction of how to develop a common language on comparing these things, but they're still not quite definitive. It really all comes down to you as the designer going through, looking at different options, calculating performance, and then selecting what's the best way to go. That's it for chapter six. Next class, we're going to move into chapter seven and part two. We talk about transient operation of converters, dynamic closed loop control. Thanks, guys.